It's Wednesday, February 18th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Jamie Gray. We've got a lot to talk about this week. It was a hard one on many of us with the sudden deaths of both Bob Simon and David Carr, the suspension of Brian Williams, and word of Jon Stewart stepping down from The Daily Show. Those four stories left many of our profession a mess with emotion, disappointment, sadness, anger, confusion, and in so many ways, it was just a shock to the system. Sunday, former Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein had this to say about the week that was and how our colleagues in the news media covered it.
All of these people we're talking about understood, including Brian Williams, the ideal of the best obtainable version of the truth. And I think this week gives us a chance, in all the horror, an opportunity to look again at who we are, what it is we do, and also maybe to throw away some of the sanctimony that we've kind of had washing over us this week. There's been too much sanctimony, too much holiness about what it is we do.
So we're going to spend the next half hour taking some of the sanctimony out of the conversation and bring some perspective to what we've lost and, more importantly, what you, the media audience, has lost. It has been a hard week, huh?
It's been a very hard week. It's, you know, it started out with Brian Williams and that saga, which is continuing at this point. People are still talking about that. And the fact that NBC's ratings are starting to sort of fluctuate now that he's been off the air for a week. And then you had Jon Stewart retiring. And then, boom, right out of the blue, you had the death of Bob Simon. And then the death of the New York Times columnist David Carr. And I actually got up on Monday, because every Monday I read David Carr's column, and it wasn't there. And that's when it really hit me. It's like, man, he is gone, you know, and that's a big shock. And when it happened and where it happened, it's been a definite shock to the New York Times.
And we're going to talk more about that. Let's start by talking about Bob Simon and that loss in a bit more detail. Sunday night, his final report aired on 60 Minutes, a look at a potential cure for Ebola. He died Wednesday evening on his way home from work just after finishing that story. Here's part-time 60 Minutes colleague Anderson Cooper sharing word of his death on CNN during primetime.
Bob was, and I'll tell you, it's very hard to talk about him in the past tense, but Bob was, for the last five decades, simply one of the best, if in my opinion, the best in the world at getting a story, telling a story, writing a story, and making it simply unforgettable. He covered virtually every major overseas conflict since the late 1960s, most notably in the Middle East. His reporting earned him 27 Emmy Awards and just about every other honor a journalist can get. Bob was a fixture on 60 Minutes and 60 Minutes 2. His daughter Tanya is a 60 Minutes producer. He was a warrior poet who loved life and loved people.
Warrior poet is a great way to describe Bob Simon. What was it that made his reporting stand out so much?
I think part of it was that he was willing to go anywhere to get the story. I mean, he covered pretty much every war from Vietnam to the current conflicts that we're involved in. And he was willing to put himself on the line to get the stories. He's done the war stories, which we talked about. He's done the human interest story. He can do stories on individuals as well as on groups. And I think he brings that kind of journalism, that old school journalism, I guess you talk about, that we don't see very much.
You talk about the idea of features and then other stories. This past Sunday, it was Ebola. The week before that, it was Selma.
And I think what he did so uniquely and in his own way, and that I think I take away from that being a broadcast journalist, is the way that he would write and really take a viewer to the location, I think was really unique. And in looking at some of the ways that his colleagues have been remembering him, I think what stands out to me is talking about someone at the network level who wants to go see every piece of video that was shot and write straight to that video and was so involved in the writing and editing process. Whereas I've seen personally in the field, sometimes network folks are relying on their field producers to do that kind of work, and they're the face on the story. Well, he was much more than the face on the story. He was really the one, as you just said, that was out there. And I think that, to me, makes the biggest difference in why his stories really sing and stand out.
I mean, when I looked at the story on 60 Minutes this past Sunday, mainly just to get a sense of where he was in his mindset on the day of his death. He had just put that story together. He was on his way home, and the crash happened. And mm-hmm. and you can see from that story that he was trying to bring a part of the Ebola story to the public that it hadn't heard. The part about there is hope for a cure, a vaccine there, and the fact that there were only these 8 or 9 that were available, and who did they go to, and why did they go to these people and not these people, and why we can't have more of it because of the complications of putting this together, and the fact that the government hasn't done mm-hmm. enough in research and development.
And that's exactly the type of story, Ernest, that you've spent the better part of the last 6 months sitting in that exact chair saying you wanted to see
exactly,
the type of reporting
exactly.
you wanted to see on Ebola. And
long-form contextual journalism, which right. that was a great example of.
Yeah, it was, and that's the story. The question becomes, okay, he's done it. Can someone else pick up the mantle and do those kinds of stories now that looks at the long term? Mm-hmm. And not just the short term, this is what's in the news now.
So, Jamie, let me pose that question to you then. How many Bob Simons are there left in network news to carry on a magazine program like 60 Minutes? We've seen, you know, back in the day when Dateline first started, it had a whole lot more sure. of that level of reporting. Now that's kind of true crime mystery, you know, for an hour sure. and told. Do we have a next generation of broadcast journalists out there to go and continue and carry that mantle forward?
Well, I certainly hope that's what we're doing here, is creating that type. I think that they are out there, and I hope and I think that it will happen, that there will be someone who is waiting in the wings, who has watched what he has done and perhaps been mentored by him, or at the very least can take that sort of style and say, hey, this is the right way to do this, and I want to be the one to tell this type of story.
The thing that bothers me is that, I mean, he could command that kind of time mm-hmm. and energy because of his stature in the sure. industry. And what concerns me is that the generation that's coming along now does not have that kind of cachet to be able to go to corporate and say, hey, give me the time, give me the resources to allow me to do these things. And that's where my concern comes in as to whether or not you're going to see those same kinds of stories that you've seen come from the 60-minute veterans like mm-hmm. like Bob Simon was. And you just I'm just afraid we're not going to get that.
Sure. Even if there's the desire, are there the resources?
Right.
Okay. Well, David Carr was another type of warrior, a journalist reporting on journalists, and it was in a way that kept all of us accountable. His Monday columns in the New York Times were a must read, many of them showing up on our Links blog week in and week out. He had a style all his own, the way he wrote, the way he interviewed, calling it like he saw it. Here's a taste. It's a scene from the documentary, Page One, and it's part of a conversation Carr had with Vice founder Shane Smith.
If you're a CNN viewer and you go, I'm looking at human on the beach.
I've got to tell you one thing. I'm a regular guy, and I go to these places, and I go, okay, everyone talked to me about cannibalism, right? Everyone talked about cannibalism. Now I'm getting a lot of saying about cannibalism and stuff, whatever. Everyone talking about cannibalism.
Yeah, most of our boys.
Yeah.
Then we drain the blood from the innocent child and drink it before going to battle.
So you kill the child?
Yes.
And then drink the blood.
Yeah.
I left it up on a chopper, I'm gonna eat it.
That's crazy. So the actual, our audience goes, that's insane. Like, that's nuts. And the New York Times, meanwhile, is writing about surfing. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? I'm not gonna talk about surfing. I'm gonna talk about cannibalism, because that me
just
up.
Just a sec, time out. Before you ever went there,
yeah.
We've had reporters there reporting on genocide after genocide, just because you put on a safari helmet and looked at some
yes,
poop
sure.
doesn't give you the right to insult what we do.
So continue. I'm just saying that I'm not
yeah.
a journalist. I'm not there to report.
Obviously.
I'm just talking.
Okay, well, that was a takedown. And David Carr certainly had lots of takedowns. Shortly after I started working here at the University of Missouri, he had written a bombshell piece about the Tribune Company, my former employer, and some of the cultural changes that had gone on there under the ownership of Sam Zell and leadership of Randy Michaels. And that has been listed among some as his trademark, his legacy pieces, and how his reporting is going to be remembered. Even last week, writing about Brian Williams and hours before collapsing and dying in the New York Times newsroom, hosted an event interviewing Edward Snowden.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I liked about David Carr's work was that he was not afraid to challenge the establishment. Mm-hmm. And it's the establishment of the media. Challenge ourselves. And we don't do enough of that in other venues. We've talked about Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart does it from a satirical perspective. David Carr does it from a journalistic perspective in which he says, look, here's where we can do better. Here's where we're doing good, but here's where we can do better. And what I'm wondering is there going to be someone out there? And I think there are. I mean, Brian Sutler's done some of that and others. So I think that there's going to be someone out there to do it, but with the finesse and the cachet and the prose that David Carr did it, that's going to be hard to replicate.
I think a lot of journalists talking about journalists can turn into an echo chamber in a way. We're all talking about each other, but who's listening outside of our circle? I think he was able to transcend that in a way, and part of it may have been the platform that he had, but I think part of it was the way that he went about it. So, you know, will we see someone step into that role in the same way? I don't know. I think that remains to be seen, but I think, you know, he was a rarity in that way of getting out of the chamber, if you will.
I think one of the things that I really like about the tributes to David Carr that have been coming out is the mentorship that he did with young journalists who are now stepping into journalists, into high profile positions within journalism. A lot of that was unknown to people who didn't really follow David and follow David's career.
Brian Stelter, you brought up his name. He's one of those perfect examples, and that's detailed in page one.
Right, exactly. And that, I think, is something that a lot of journalists, even today in journalism, don't get a lot of credit for the mentorship that they're doing with the next generation that's coming up. And hopefully a lot of those stories can be told while people are still with us and not being told after they're gone.
That's one of those things is somebody who's now stepped into the role of journalism educator. In a lot of ways, I always considered myself a journalism educator, and perhaps that's because of the Missouri method that anytime an intern or a student walked into the newsroom, we were all in the role of helping teach that person, the idea of each one teach one and moving forward. David Carr, for the first time formally last fall, stepped into a classroom teaching at Boston University. His syllabus for the class he called Press Play, so you can look at that in the double entendre there, is available online, and we'll put a link to it on the Links blog. But even his approach to journalism education was innovative and pushing the envelope just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he was an early adopter of technology and
Twitter and now Medium.
Exactly, and talked about it over and over again in his columns. I mean, even if you were a journalist and didn't quite embrace the changes that technology was bringing, you could still learn a lot from reading his column because he broke it down in a way in which even, you know, Luddites like me, when it comes to technology, can at least understand it. So
you're not a Luddite at all. So we're going to talk a little bit more about technology and bringing technology into journalism. Loyal listeners to our program know one thing we follow closely here at the Missouri School of Journalism and at KBIA is the FAA's actions on drones and the use of drones in this country. As you know, we started a drone journalism project in 2013, and the FAA ostensibly grounded it. Well, this week we got our first look at what the agency intends to do about regulating drones in the U.S. airspace, and it looks like drones for journalism could become a thing again, and that would be legally. Under this proposal, this is not yet policy, this is not yet law, but who would be able to use drones and what would that look like?
Well, I think from the broadcast standpoint, it's going to be and for photographers, it's going to be very good in terms of journalism. But you also have in strategic communication, advertising, public relations, they'll be able to use it to do videos and photos in places and in ways that was really going to enhance them. I think scientists are looking forward to using this, agriculturalists, farmers, you know, people who just have, if you have whole herds of cattle, and instead of sending somebody out in a truck, you could send a drone out to make sure that, you know, your cattle is in a certain area. So I think it's going to have a lot of applications, but the fear has always been from the FAA, how do we control this? And how do we make sure that people are using it the right way and not causing security problems or problems for airliners?
Or even privacy concerns, which of course is a big one when we're talking about journalism. Where is that reasonable expectation of privacy? I mean, right now on the ground, we have pretty clear rules, if you will, laws in a lot of cases. You know, on the sidewalk, you're fine. Being in someone's yard once they ask you to leave, not okay. Are we then going to make some sort of altitude thing, too? Do we just need to bring the plane up into the air? I think that actually might be what happens, is that there has to be some sort of way to determine where your reasonable expectation of privacy is with a drone.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when I was looking over the rules, because it say you can only go so many feet in the air, you can only go so fast, these sorts of things. Well, what's to keep someone from saying, wait a minute, you're invading my privacy and taking out their gun and just shooting down a drone? It's still got some hiccups to it that they're going to have to work out. But I do think that ultimately we will get to a point where it becomes another tool that journalists and others can use to better bring news and information to the public.
And we've always had to adapt. I mean, once live trucks became a thing, it had to be, okay, how are we going to handle a standoff situation? The police don't want us broadcasting their positions because that puts them in danger, and we have those conversations. So when GoPro cameras came about and suddenly you had this tiny camera you could put in all these different places, there was that conversation. This is that next conversation of how is this going to work and when is it acceptable, and all of those conversations.
So one of the questions then that I would put back at you, looking through some of these regulations, one of the things that it does say is that you can't fly it over people who aren't in control of it. So that would kind of rule out sending a drone to cover a protest, say like what we saw in Ferguson. Right. It would rule out sending a drone over the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. What instances from a journalism standpoint could you see using a drone in order to get additional footage or photos or whatever that might be?
I think coming from the Mountain West as a reporter, wildfires, if we could have gotten a drone up in the air to check on wildfires and where they were burning and how close to homes, that would have been really valuable information for us, and I think would fit into the parameters of what's being discussed. So I think in a lot of ways, weather type of scenarios may be good for that.
Regionally tornado damage.
Absolutely.
Same type of thing.
And in general, some of those backwoods areas where you aren't able to see what's going on, I think there's some valuable footage of even the Missouri River. It'd be great to have some nice video of the Missouri River from above.
I mean, to me, it's one of those things where areas that were inaccessible is where drones are really going to help in terms of getting news and information out to the public and to visually show what's happening, especially when you're talking about tornadoes, mm-hmm. hurricane damage. So the weather coverage is really going to benefit from this. And then I think once they start using it, you'll begin to see other applications of how it can actually bring that news and information back.
Our next story comes to us from Kansas City, where NBC affiliate KSHB put its helicopter up Friday over a high-speed chase. The incident ended with police fatally shooting the carjacker, and KSHB aired the whole thing live on the air.
From earlier today, I can show you video that SkyTracker was able to get of this wild chase that started over in Bonner Springs. And in that chase, you can see the suspect in that vehicle really driving almost like a four-wheeling show. I mean, really going all over the place. Police were able to throw down stop sticks, and that's when everything started to unfold here.
Our online and television audience may have noticed when the reporter was talking about the carjacker driving as though he was four-wheeling, a pickup truck appeared a little bit fuzzy on the screen. That's because in subsequent reports throughout the day, the station blurred out the actual shooting that had happened live on the air the first time. There are some out there who think car chases make great television and want to put every single one of them live on the air. Jamie, you're shaking your head at me.
I have been maybe fortunate to not work at a TV station that had a helicopter parked on the rooftop because we never had to make this type of quick decision. I don't think it's newsworthy in almost every scenario that I can think of. I think it's being put out there for sensationalism. Will people watch? Absolutely they'll watch. Do people want to know what happens at the end? Absolutely. How many times do these things end well, though? I actually looked up some statistics from the FBI. 1 in 100 high-speed pursuits ends up with somebody dying. Is that a statistic you're willing to put on the news?
Or to risk having.
Yeah. I mean, if 1 in 100, that's pretty significant amount. And it's not, I just don't think it's in the interest of the viewer to put that type of thing on television as it's happening. Now, do you tape it and air portions of it later? Yes, perhaps. But this whole live car chase going on for hours at times, I just don't think is worth the risk.
You know, I think it's one of those things where when you start to see it over and over and over again, it moves from news to becoming entertainment. Mm-hmm. So people are watching it to see the crash. It's sort of like, you know, why do people go to hockey matches who aren't real hockey fans? To see a fight break out. They want to see a fight break out. Same thing with NASCAR. You know, people who aren't real NASCAR fans and understand it go watch NASCAR because they want to see the cars crash. Well, it's starting to become the same thing because you're seeing this over and over again. Either the car is crashing or the cops are shooting at the car. They put the sticks down and they start tumbling out of control. I mean, but where's the news there? I mean, what's the news value?
Well, I'm guessing there's somebody out there who could argue, and I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm not necessarily saying I'm the person who would argue, but this happened during rush hour. There are people who are trying to get to work. There are people who are trying to get their kids to school. This incident started as a carjacking. So it was also, well, I don't know if this is a reason to put it on the air, but it's technically an active crime scene the whole time that it's going on too.
Sure. And I, that's why I hesitate to say, no, this should never happen, mm-hmm. because there's always that scenario. Or, you know, if you say during rush hour, I think I've read examples where, you know, it involved like a school bus full of children, those types of things. Sometimes there is a significant public interest in an immediacy and people do need to know which streets to avoid, those types of things. But there is a way to cover that without this wall-to-wall play-by-play of what's going on when, frankly, there's usually not a lot of facts to back up what's happening. So it's this say play-by-play dramatization. If it's which streets are closed off, where to watch out for, and you can put it on a delay and do it properly, then I think there may be times for it. But as much as we're seeing it, I just don't think so.
And I think that, to me, that's part of the problem, is that it's not reported the way you're talking about. It's not reported as news. It's the play-by-play entertainment value of it that causes a lot of the angst among those of us who are saying, wait a minute, that's not very beneficial to the audience.
Well, and in this case, KSHB did catch some heat from viewers who went on Facebook, who went on Twitter, basically saying, I think I just watched a man die live on TV this morning over my Wheaties.
Yeah, you've got to think about your audience. I mean, is this really something that you want to be known for? Because it goes back to what I say all the time. It's not what you meant to do, it's what you did. Mm-hmm. You were trying to cover a story that you thought was important, but then you didn't stop to think about the ethical implications of what the end game was going to be. And they got caught up in the moment and didn't think about, whoa, wait a minute. You know, we're going to have to cut away from this for a minute until it actually happened.
And they got the 1 in 100 that day, and it came off badly.
Yeah.
Okay. Sunday night, one of television's longest-running programs, marked its 40th anniversary. The 3.5-hour Saturday Night Live special drew a record audience on TV and online. Imagine everyone you've seen on SNL over the last 40 years, almost all of them showed up in that show in one way or another. That included former stars, hosts, some of whom were at one time the butt of NSL's biggest jokes.
Yes, Tina.
Yeah, no, it's Sarah.
Oh,
Sarah,
sorry. Yes. Governor Palin, welcome.
Yeah, I was just curious, Jerry, how much do you think Lauren Michaels would pay me if I were to run in 2016?
Run for president, Sarah? I don't think there's a number too big.
Okay, just hypothetically then, what if I were to choose Donald Trump as my running mate?
Sarah, you're teasing us. That's not nice. I'll see you at the party. Larry, are you going to the party?
No.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Some parts of that show were good. Others, well, maybe the best part of Saturday Night Live is when it can laugh at itself. Take a listen, see what I mean.
From Studio 8H in Rockefeller Center, it's Weekend Update with Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Jane Curtin.
I'm Jane Curtin.
I'm Tina Fey.
And I'm Amy Poehler. And here are tonight's top stories. Saturday Night Live turns 40 years old this week with a live 3.5-hour broadcast that won an Emmy in the first 10 minutes and then lost it somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Monday morning, the headline on the New York Times' review of the program read, "The SNL 40th anniversary show, very funny, except when it wasn't." What did you guys think of it?
Oh, I loved it. I loved every minute. Well, maybe not every minute of it. There were some of the musical performances I could have dealt without. But I thought for 3.5 hours, and you have to remember, they're putting up new content with their greatest hits over the last decade. So when you stand up with those 40 years of greatest hits next to something new, yeah, maybe it's not their next greatest hit, but I thought it was great. I thought it was fun. I thought it was entertaining. I loved every moment of it.
Well, I went in and out. I didn't watch all 3.5 hours
as
of it.
Did I?
And the parts I did see, they were funny. Some were funny. Some were nostalgic, which I kind of liked. Just to see the people in there the way they were on Saturday Night Live, and then to see where they are now. That I thought was very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of stars that came out of that. Then when you start to go back and think about it, and some people you don't even remember that's where they got their start.
Or the people who weren't there, Phil Hartman, Gilda Radner. It also reminded you of Chris Farley, of all the people that we've lost.
Then, and I think that they did a very good job of making sure that they recognized them. Some of it didn't come off the way they had planned. They tried to make light of it when they probably shouldn't have. But I think all in all, they did a pretty good job in memorializing those past characters.
The other thing I really liked is their recognition of the crew that has been with them, the musicians, the writers that had passed were there in that montage right along
and
with the honor.
Hearing the gasps from
talent.
The audience.
Exactly. And
told
it was
you how
more
much those
for those
people,
writers.
How much those people meant. Saturday Night Live is an interesting program, and taking a look at its legacy as well in kind of that media history and women who've been able to break through, people of color who've been able to break through. And sometimes that program made news in its own right, remembering Sinead O'Connor ripping up a picture of the Pope and how that program made news.
I mean, I don't think you wouldn't have a Jon Stewart if you didn't have Weekend Update. You wouldn't have Comedy Central. And a lot of the formats that you see Comedy Central in if you didn't have SNL. So I think that the whole 3.5 hours pretty much played homage to something that is long lasting that I think is going to continue in various forms.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the original keeping up with what's going on during the week and bringing it to you almost every weekend when they're in season. And I think it's great.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and Maya Jackson for directing today's show, to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hannah Smith is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.